Well, you see, Mandela was in jail when I was here. And I think we helped start the process to get him out of jail. In fact, I was, it was at a conference in Lesotho, and President Joe Biden was Senator Joe Biden then, and we couldn't land the big American jet in Lesotho, so we had to land in South Africa. And when they brought us back to our plane, it was mostly a black delegation, but everybody was casual. And the guards that were keeping us between two fences had never seen black people flying a four-engine jet that way. And he said, "I cannot let you in until the colonel gets here." Well, Charlie Rangel, who's congressman from New York, said, "Damn it, that's the colonel." And the colonel happened to be, black fella, but he happened to have on shorts and a T-shirt because it was very hot then. He didn't realize most of us were congressmen. We identify with Africa because so many of our citizens have come from Africa. I don't know how we came. I don't know when we came. I'm not even sure. Well, my DNA tests indicate that my ancestors, probably some of them were from the Mende tribes along West Africa. But there's a missing link there. So I have never been able to make that connection.
You were the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. at a time when the United States was taking greater interest in Africa. But what led the government, or what inspired the government, to have more interest in Africa and thus South Africa?
No, I think that it was President Jimmy Carter, who came from Georgia and was from Sumter County, which is 80% black. And he grew up mostly with black people. He was in the same situation that most white South Africans were in. And he had lived in it all his life. And so when I met with Minister of Defense, P.W. Botha, he asked me, "How long do you think we have before the bloodbath?" And I said, "I don't think you'll have a bloodbath." He said, "How can you say that? How can you say that?" He said, "Surely someday these black people are going to rise up and kill us all." And I said, "I really don't believe that." And I said, "President Carter has grown up in a situation very much like this, and he sent me to tell you that if you are serious about a multiracial democracy, he would be glad to work with you personally and put the full power of the United States government behind you."
And now, do you recall your very first meeting with Mr. Mandela?
I'm afraid I don't. And the reason is that, well, I first went to South Africa in 74, and he was still in jail. I couldn't meet with him, but I did meet with Robert Sobukwe of the Pan-Africanist movement, who had just gotten out of jail after 9 years. They let him out because he had cancer. And the only thing he asked was, "I know I'm on my last legs, and I wish you would help my children get an education." So I was with Arthur Ashe and Bob Green of Michigan State.
Arthur Ashe, of course, being the famous American tennis player, African-American tennis player.
And so we brought three of his children back, and they stayed with me. We put them in the junior college for a year just to make sure that they caught up if they were behind. And they were very bright. And then we transferred them to Michigan State. The sufferings of poor people and black people and white people in South Africa. The problem is poverty, and poverty knows no color. And very few of our economies are functioning for 100% of our citizens. We probably have a highest percentage maybe in the United States, but we probably have close to 20% now that are in need of food, clothing, or shelter, health care, or education. In fact, it's probably more than 20%.
And how does Mr. Mandela's vision, well, his, the late Mr. Mandela's vision of a world that is much more equal and just and where human rights are respected and racial equality is a reality, how does that influence or have a role to play?
Well, in his tribal background, and I don't remember what that was, they did a pretty good job of taking care of everybody. And so he was not traditionally used to ignoring a percentage of the people. His grandfather was one of the leaders of that group, and he saw to it that everybody had a fair opportunity. And that was what Mandela hoped for, not only for South Africa, but for all of Africa and the world. There was a song we used to sing in the civil rights movement and in the U.S., freedom is a constant struggle. We struggle so long that we must be free. Well, I'm 91 now, and I've had as good a life as anybody can have in anywhere in the world, I think. But I grew up for most of my life in a segregated Southland. And I was deprived of certain opportunities. But the opportunities that I was deprived of, I'm almost glad I missed. Because what it did was it put the burden of responsibility on my parents. And they assumed it. So they didn't wait for me to get to a good school. They started making me learn at home. and I could read before I went to school. We have to find ways to do better, everybody. And it's not easy, and it's not automatic. And I think that's why Mandela understood that freedom is a constant struggle. And he spent most of his life in that struggle. But the truth of it is, his struggle wasn't nearly as bad and as difficult as his wife Winnie Mandela's struggle was. He was more protected in jail than she was at the mercy of Afrikaner troops and riot squads and the segregation or apartheid that her family suffered. Now, they struggled and they went a long way towards overcoming it, but it was only because they never stopped fighting. They were fighting not white people. They were fighting ignorance. They were fighting poor health. They were fighting lack of opportunities.
And you got to know Mr. Mandela not only through his struggle, but he also became a friend of yours. What was he like as a person?
He had a wonderful sense of humor. He was always joking. And in fact, somebody sent me some of his jokes. But there was one of his professors that really didn't like him. And he was in the cafeteria eating, and one of the few seats was next to this professor. So he went and sat down. And the professor said, "Don't you realize that pigs, swine, and birds don't eat together?" And his answer was, "Oh, excuse me, I'll fly away."
He was very sharp-witted and also very compassionate as well. And now, of course, we're here for the UN celebration of his life and legacy, which we celebrate every year on the 18th of July, which is his birthday. Going forward, how do we carry Mr. Mandela's legacy? Because it's been 10 years since he's left us. How do we keep that alive?
Well, the same way we do with Jesus, and the same way we do with Moses, the same way we do with Martin Luther King. We keep telling the story. Not a day passes when, for some reason, I don't have an occasion to tell a story about Martin Luther King. And Mandela Day gives us a reason to celebrate the way Mandela dealt with the controversies in his life. And one of the things that shocks everybody was that he insisted when he was sworn in as president that his jailer be seated with his family. And after all, the jailer had been with him in jail for 27 years and was probably as close to him as his family, but it sent a wonderful message to the nation of South Africa that we are not against people because of their color. We're against people because of their policies. And it was obvious that this jailer had been very friendly to him while he was in jail for 27 years. And he thought of him as family.
That speaks volumes. Mr. Andrew Young, former United States Ambassador to the UN, politician and always an activist, thank you so much for speaking to UN News. Is there anything further you would like our audience to know about Nelson Mandela or about the need to continue to keep his legacy alive?
Well, I don't think Nelson Mandela ever gave up, in jail or out of jail, struggling with white politics or black politics. He was always engaged in a struggle and always tried to be on the right side of justice and freedom and equality.